Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Seacrest. Life comes at you fast, which is why it's important to find some time to relax. A little you time. Enter Chumba Casino. With no download required, you can jump on anytime, anywhere for the chance to redeem some serious prizes. So treat yourself with Chumba Casino and play over 100 online casino-style games, all for free. Go to ChumbaCasino.com to collect your free welcome bonus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. I'm Michael Steele. It is always a treat when you come into the house, especially in a new year. A happy new year, everybody. So glad you could join us. I hope you're having a wonderful holiday. Because for me, you know, the New Year celebration lasts a little bit more than just one day. It's about a week to 10 days, because that's how long it takes to recover from what the hell happened on New Year's Eve. But that's a whole nother conversation. We are starting off the new year in the classroom. I think it's important for folks to get the education on and understand exactly what's standing in front of them, understand exactly what's happening around them, and obtain a little perspective. I think a lot of times Americans lose perspective on things and not really understand the nitty-gritty. Well, we've got someone to help break it down for us. She is an accomplished and incomparable individual. She is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University and author of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, a New York Times bestseller, Washington Post Notable Book of 2016, and a National Book Critics Circle Award winner. She is also the author of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy, which was long listed, folks, for the National Book Award and a finalist for the Penn Galbraith Award in Nonfiction. Her latest book is the second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. She is Dr. Carol Anderson. Oh, baby, welcome.
Thank you so much, Michael. Thank you.
It is such a treat to have you. And you've written I'd say books that provide perspective and understanding. And it's not, I just want to put this on the table straight up for folks. At least in my reading, it's not from a political perspective. You're not coming to the table with an agenda. You're looking and saying, hey, y'all, do y'all see what I see?
I am a historian. I'm looking at the data. I'm looking at the stories that people tell. I'm looking at the documents, and I'm putting them together so that we understand how we got here. You know, there's a song by Graham Central Station called Ghetto, and it says, I'm still trying to figure out how we got here, because I know it wasn't on our own. How did we get here? Because that, knowing that, it allows us to figure out how do we get out of this mess.
So let's start at the beginning. Let's start with the first book. I'll put it that way, because we're going to go through the books to your current one, White Rage. Yes. White Rage really upset some people. there were a number of folks who were a little bit outdone. What was it you were trying to get across in this book? It's an operational function of white supremacy. Yes. Tell us what you mean by that, and tell us how, because remember, white, of course you remember, but White Rage was written in 2016. This wasn't something that oh yeah, Trump's here now, I'm going to write about white rage. This is something, as an historian, you have been tracking for a while. How have white supremacy operationalized white rage?
I love that question. Thank you. It comes out of what I saw was this pattern, an inexorable pattern, where African Americans would achieve some major gain in terms of their citizenship rights, in terms of their civil rights. And the response was this massive policy and legal backlash against those rights. And so you ask yourself, self, how is it that we had a civil war? And then doggone near 100 years later, we had to have a civil rights movement. What happened in that time? And so it's understanding this massive backlash, this policy backlash in terms of court decisions, in terms of laws that are passed. And so I look at it in terms of, I define rage in terms of those policies. We often think of rage as this violence that's raining down on folks. But white rage operates where it looks legitimate. It cloaks itself in the legitimacy of political and legal power to undermine those advances.
In fact, you note white rage is legitimized the policies that make up the American political framework. It lives in voter ID laws and manifests in the Black votes that aren't cast at all. It lives in criminal sentencing laws and plays out in a war on drugs that was waged against Black people. It is the rage that fueled the insurrectionists who stormed the Capitol on January 6th. And so I really take note of how you began the conversation, because it is true in my own experience that when you see an inch of progress by Black folks, there's a mile of anger that follows it. And I look at the critical race theory discussion, which we'll get into in a little bit, because what I saw there were people outraged about something they didn't know jack about. Okay, number one, I mean, you've got these white women in suburban America pulling their hair out over their five-year-old learning critical race theory. I'm like, ma'am. Do you know what it is, number one? And then number two, do you know where it's taught? There's not a white institution in this country that's teaching critical race theory.
And I said, if your kindergartner is learning critical race theory, your baby deserves to be in Mensa.
Yes.
Right? You know, but because what that battle really is about beginning to flatten out and erase the history of the United States of America. It is about wanting to create this sense, I call it the Rick Santorum school of history. Mm-hmm. Remember where he said,
oh, yes,
this was an empty land and then the Europeans came and we built this. So if you have this narrative that white men built this nation all by themselves, then it creates a policy foundation that they are the makers and everybody else are the takers.
How does white rage apply to where we are right now? So there's so many places you can stick a pen on that one, but I'll let you do that.
Okay. Where it applies right now is when you think about that 2020 election. This is an election in the midst of a pandemic that is wiping out folks. But Black folk and brown folk and doggone near everybody else knew that democracy hung in the balance, that if we had another 4 years of the Trump regime that had already proven itself to be lawless in so many ways, democracy was over, because the only thing holding him back was the need to get reelected. And so you had folks standing in line for 8 to 11 hours to vote.
Right.
You had folks who were standing in line in the midst of a pandemic to vote. I remember the decision up in Wisconsin that required, because they didn't get the absentee ballots out to folk in time. And the Supreme Court is like, yeah, bees that way sometimes. And so folks were having to stand in line and face the perils of a pandemic to vote.
Right.
What we saw then was this absolute commitment to American democracy by folks that then, when you get the backlash saying they stole the election in Philadelphia, they stole the election in Atlanta, they stole the election in Milwaukee. Those are cities with sizable Black populations, basically saying that Black folks do not have the right to vote. If right. we don't count their votes, then Trump wins. And so the response, and you had all kinds of audits, you had all kinds of lawsuits, finding that there's none of this massive rampant voter fraud, nothing was stolen, but it didn't matter. Because then the response is a wave of policies, a wave of laws mm-hmm. coming across these states, figuring out how do we shut down access to the ballot box for all of those people that we don't believe are legitimate voters, that we don't believe are legitimate American citizens.
So a couple of things I want to pull from that. One is, where in your mind then do we get this white supremacy piece, this white anger piece wrong? Where do we go wrong in our assessment of this? Because I think one of the things that that makes it easier, especially for some folks on my side who seemingly want to embrace white nationalism now, and is that when we this is unrelated to what's going on. In other words, January 6th were citizens who were upset about the government, fill in the blank. What happened in Charlottesville, they came peacefully. Trump was right. There are fine people on both sides. You're elevating, the innocence. And that's what we see happening with the young woman who was killed.
Ashley Babbitt.
Yep. Who was killed. She's now lionized as some heroic figure. Where do we get this wrong in our looking at and understanding of what's actually happening?
And we get it wrong. And this is what I talk about in White Rage on the chapter Rolling Back Civil Rights, mm-hmm. is that we have defined racism. We have defined white supremacy being just the Klan. And so unless it's in a sheet and a hood, then it's not racism, and it allows us to individualize it instead of thinking about it systemically, instead of thinking about what does it mean when we close down 6 of 7 polling places in a county that is 61% Black. What does that mean? Because that's a system thing.
Right.
And so when we don't look at it in terms of the system, but we only see these individuals and we're not seeing them dressed up as Klansmen, right. then we're like, well, that's not racism. And it also is part and parcel of the Lee Atwater Southern strategy thing. When he said in 54, you could say the N-word, it wouldn't hurt you. But by 68, it backfires.
Right.
So you start getting really abstract. And you start talking about all of these economic things like taxes and forced busing and states' rights. He said, but the whole point of it is that Blacks get hurt worse than whites. There are two major components in there. One is you see the cloaking of white supremacy, where you can't say the N-word anymore, but you use these other kind of policy terms, economic terms, to do the same kind of damage. Mm-hmm. The second piece is that Blacks get hurt, but so do whites. And so the whites who are the collateral damage become the fig leaf to say, How could this be racist? Whites weren't able to vote either.
Right. Yeah.
So it provides cover. That's how this thing works.
Well, there's another side to that too that's I've always found very interesting, where it almost seems that in, particularly on the policy side, in the pursuit of enforcing the institution, the institutionalized racism that folks don't want to talk about because they think it's not real, but we know it is. What often happens is poor, disadvantaged white folk get caught up in that ish as well. I mean, and so when you, I sit there and I remember having, I got into a spat a few years ago with a member of Congress from the great state of Mississippi, who was going off about Black folks wanting something, and was made an unfortunate reference that is always the case, that implies if you're poor, you're Black, right? Because that's the equation in a lot of folks' mind, whether people appreciate it or not. When you start hearing people talking about poor people and disadvantaged people, what is the image that immediately comes to your mind?
Boom.
Right? All right. So that again, to your point, Professor, is part of the institutionalization of racism. Yes. Through the system. So I get into this thing and I had to point out to this congressman, I said, well, I took a look at your district. The largest recipients of welfare programs in your district are white people.
Boom.
Not Black people.
Boom.
The poorest people in your district are white people, not Black people. So why are you inferring that Black people are the problem?
And this gets foundational to makers and takers, so that you get Black folks always want a government handout. They don't want to work for anything. Black people are lazy. So this becomes part of that narrative that is based on this false history of who built this incredible nation, who fought for this nation, who was part and parcel of building this incredible nation. When you erase the role of African Americans in this nation, and then they show up saying, you know, schools, quality schools, when they show up talking about clean drinking water, when they show up talking about equal pay for equal work, they want a handout. They want to take from those who have built this.
So let me ask you a question. Yeah. Would a Flint, Michigan happen or be allowed to continue in Potomac, Maryland?
You already knew the answer to your question.
would a Flint, Michigan be allowed to happen in Bel Air or in the Hamptons?
And what you see is that when the governor of Michigan wanted to do that kind of receivership over Detroit.
Yeah.
Stop Detroit from being able to sell clean water to Flint. Now you see, he didn't do that in the Upper Peninsula.
No.
He did it to Detroit and to Flint.
And so a companion piece, and we're going to, I want to move us into your second book, which is How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy.
Yes.
The second piece is what we see on the voting side, because the one thing I hope folks get from the conversation or begin to piece together for themselves are the dots are there. All you need to do is now connect them, right? It really is. So the next connective piece of tissue is around voting.
Yes.
And when you look at, so we were just talking about Flint, folks, where I asked the question, would a Flint, Michigan, somewhat damn near 5 years later, be allowed to still be without clean running water, et cetera, if this were a largely white suburban community? We all know that every white folk person out there know the answer to that question, right? I ask it rhetorically because I just want to ask the question, the obvious. But you got to think about what the answer really says.
Yes.
The second piece is, why do we not seem to show concern when the state of Texas, that Donald Trump won by 5.5% in 2020, won the state, feels it's necessary to audit the four counties that he lost, which were Black and brown, majority Black and brown counties. Now, again, connect the damn dots, people, right? I mean, am I missing something here?
Not nary a thing. because part and parcel of this is that language of voter fraud is tied to Blackness and is tied to cities. So it becomes just an easy step with the criminalization of Blackness to say, look at these Black folks stealing our democracy. Look at these Black folks stealing our election. This is why when the Trump campaign did an audit of Wisconsin, they only audited Milwaukee and Dane counties, right? Where 74% of the state's Black population lives, because they said that's where all of the problems are. This is why Newt Gingrich identifies this election got stolen in these cities of Philadelphia, Milwaukee, and Atlanta, where you have sizable Black populations. When you identify the threat to American democracy, the theft of American democracy with Black people, and that criminalization is part and parcel of a long ongoing narrative about how Black people are a threat to the white community, to American democracy. When you have that long history there, they're tapping into a deep, rich vein. And so it becomes logical that the fraud would be happening in Houston. It becomes logical that the fraud would be happening in Dallas and Fort Worth.
From your perspective as a historian, why aren't we pissed off about that? I did a Zoom event for a class at NYU. A friend of mine teaches there, and I had this class. There were about 60 students in this class, in this seminar. And he asked me, I was on with my buddy, Jonathan Capehart. We did it together. And at the beginning, he asked both of us a question, which was, you know, is American democracy in trouble? Right? And when he came to me, I paused and I looked at the camera to the Zoom students. I said, well, I want to answer this a little bit differently. Do you think it's in trouble? Because I don't see any signs from the American people that it really is. I mean, 71% of the people in my party believe the election was stolen. Clearly, a third of Americans believe the same thing. So I don't know if we believe that. And I guess the question, just to bring it forward, is why don't we see the kind of response I thought we would have seen in the 1950s and 60s to an effort to systematically take away your right to vote?
I love that question. and that is because of the power of the Southern strategy, because so much of the uprising that we saw in the civil rights movement is because you had the N-word peppered over everything. You had Senator James O. Eastland, just not holding back. You had the Southern Democrats not holding back, going for it, making it very clear that Black people were expendable. Black people were a threat to the Southern way of life.
Right.
Now, when you paper that over with we want election integrity, We want to protect democracy. We want to end voter fraud. And you have all of the kind of legitimizing features there, such as Supreme Court decisions, right, such as state legislatures and the Congress and the governors doing things that give it that aura of legitimacy, then it looks like this is just a regular function of government in order to maintain democracy. What we don't see is how villainous this is, how racially based this is, how this is designed to stop American citizens.
Why are we still, go ahead, Professor.
Because Americans, and so this is also part of what shocks me about January 6th. Americans are drawn to the spectacular, to right, the violence. This bureaucratic violence that we've been seeing, these many years, has been quiet, it's been subtle, it's been methodical. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't draw the media. You don't have a picture. If you don't have the picture, so we see the pictures of the people standing in line, right, to vote, but we don't get what's underneath that, which is that you've had a series of policy decisions that have decided to not put enough working machines in Black precincts and not to have enough poll workers in Black precincts that makes the lines so long.
And I think that's one of the things that, for me, that's kind of obvious. I mean, you see that. I mean, you can actually draw a direct line. Okay, the lines are longer here because two cycles ago, 8 years ago, whatever, this precinct had 30 machines. Now it's got 5.
Boom. Boom.
Before Republicans changed the law in, the voting laws, grandma used to walk down the street to the corner church to vote. Now grandma has to catch a bus to go cross town.
Boom. Boom.
And I don't understand why we objectively, when we see that, when we hear that, when we realize that's what's happening, there's no outrage. I mean, I would have thought during the Trump years, I even said this on MSNBC a number of times, I'm like, where are the protests? Where are people in the street, saying, what the hell are you doing?
Right. Okay. So let's take Indiana. Right. So remember in 2008 when Indiana went for Obama?
Right.
Okay. The Republicans in Indiana basically did a Fred Sanford. They clutched their heart talking about Elizabeth.
It's a big one, Elizabeth. Oh, Lord. I'm coming home.
And they were like, no, how did this happen? And they figured out it was via early voting. Particularly early voting coming out of Marion County, where Indianapolis is. Black folks were using early voting. And so Indiana passed a law that in counties that had more than 325,000 residents, they could only have one early voting site. Counties that had fewer could have more.
Because that makes mathematical sense, if not common sense.
Right. And there are only 3 counties in Indiana that have more than 325,000 people.
And guess who live there?
Boom. The counties with Gary, Fort Wayne, and Indianapolis.
Oh, so, my Lord.
Any wonder that in 2012, that early voting in those counties dropped precipitously.
Of course it did. Right? Because Black people ain't stupid. They're like, all right, I guess I won't vote.
I mean, when you've got and this is that what I call that bureaucratic violence. It is a series of policies that, just like Jim Crow, when Mississippi passed the Mississippi Plan of 1890, it wasn't just one thing. It wasn't just the poll tax.
Right.
It was the literacy test. It was the good character clause. It was the understanding clause. South Carolina jumped in there with the white primary, and you had the grandfather clause that would provide a loophole for poor whites to be able to vote for a minute. They could rise up as these laws were being passed, right?
Oh my God.
And so when you think about how our voting laws are now, so you have voter ID, which is supposed to be predicated on stopping fraud. But again, just like the big lie, they can't point to the massive rampant voter fraud
right. That
before voter IDs were there. So you've got poll closures, ostensibly to balance the books, because, you know, all of this is so expensive having all of these polls open.
But you want more polls. You want more polling places. You want greater access. And just for all the Republicans out there who come to the table with this bullshit about, you know, early voting and vote by mail, how the hell do you think we won in 2010? Boom. What the hell do you think I did? Why do you think I had a 50-state strategy? Why do you think I was on a bus traveling around the damn country going to polling precincts to get people to early vote and to participate in the process? I mean, don't just come back now because some orange-haired guy from New York City who happened to be president at the time tells you, oh, well, vote by mail is fraudulent, even as he votes not once but twice by mail.
Thank you
very much.
Thank you.
That you believe this crap. I mean, it is fundamental. We have been voting by mail. Guess what? Since Ben Franklin created the damn post office.
I mean, what we see then, it isn't the method of voting. It is who voted
that
way.
Thank you. That's the rub. That's it right there.
I mean, so we saw it. I saw it. You'll see this in One Person, No Vote, where I talk about how when Maggie Bozeman and Julia Wilder in Alabama realized in their county that it was absentee voting that was the way that whites were able to stay in power. And so they learned how to use absentee voting. And Black folks started using absentee voting.
They're like, wait a minute, hold up.
Hold up. They started hollering voter fraud and threw them in prison.
Well, who was the sister that got who's got 5 years in prison in Texas?
Thank you. Sanders.
Yes.
Crystal Sanders.
Crystal Sanders.
I mean, it just, and you think about it, she gets 5 years, but the guy who in Arizona who said, I don't know how my dead wife was able to vote.
Privilege. Right. Privilege. Right. All right. So we're about to get violent up in here when we come back, because we're going to get into the second, race and guns in a fatally unequal America, with Professor Carol Anderson. Oh my gosh, this is about to get deep. Y'all hang with us now. We'll be right back.
All right, America, you asked for it. Or maybe you didn't. But either way, we have to talk. You're just in kind of a crazy place right now, Mr. and Mrs. USA. So we're going to sit down a couple of times a week and work it out between us. The way Americans do. On a podcast. Hosted by Beowulf Rocklin. Weird name. Weird news. Weird politics. Weird country. Facepalm America. Available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele Podcast. We are having a great conversation with Professor Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, and the author of three important books, and we're talking about each of them. White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide, How, let's see, what, let me get, yeah, one person, one vote, no vote, one person, no vote, how voter suppression is destroying our democracy. And now we're going to turn our attention to her latest book called The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. So I'm just going to let you start us off on that one, because I just love the title. And there is, as you know, roughly 300 and almost 400 million guns in spread out across America. And we're only a country of about 325 million people. So Houston, we got a problem.
We got a problem. We got a problem. And
I say that as someone who is supportive of the Second Amendment and all that it means, but I ain't crazy, but I'll turn it over to the professor. Go ahead.
So what started me on this book was the killing of Philando Castile.
Mm.
Because here you had a Black man in Minnesota who was pulled over by the police.
Right.
And he asked to see his ID. And so Philando Castile, following NRA guidelines, alerts the police officer that he has a license to carry weapon, but he is reaching for his ID so that the police officer isn't surprised when he sees a gun.
Right.
The cop hears, you got a gun, and the police officer starts shooting. 5 bullets, kills Philando Castile with a child sitting in the back seat. Lord have mercy.
Yeah.
And the NRA, this guardian of the Second Amendment, goes virtually silent, because here we have a Black man who is shot for merely having a gun, not for brandishing a weapon, not right. for threatening somebody with a weapon, but for merely having a legally licensed to carry gun.
Right.
And so it took the Black members of the NRA to push the NRA to make a statement. And the NRA says something to the effect of, well, we believe that everybody should have the right to bear arms. Now, this is the same NRA after Ruby Ridge and Waco
right.
called federal law enforcement jackbooted government thugs.
Yep.
But goes virtually, it bees that way sometimes when it comes to a Black man getting killed. And so you had pundits asking, well, don't Black people have Second Amendment rights? And for all of my work, because I have 2 other books before these 3, mm-hmm. Eyes Off the Prize and Bourgeois Radicals, and all of them, I'm looking at the rights of African Americans. I had never explored the right to bear arms, the Second Amendment. And so I went hunting, and I ended up back in the 17th century.
Do we need to go get a drink real quick?
yes, Lord, call his name. And there I saw this incredible fear of Black people and the laws emanating out of that fear of the enslaved, and the fear of free Blacks as well, that they were dangerous. They were a threat to the white community, to the safety of the white community. And so you saw these series of laws coming in talking about thou shalt not bear arms. Black folks cannot have weapons.
Right.
They cannot have guns. They cannot have ammunition. They cannot. And you see this coming through. And so I'm following this all the way. Actually, I'm following it all the way up to Kyle Rittenhouse. But in the book, but what I see coming in with the Second Amendment itself is that when the Constitution was being ratified, and they're going from state to state for this ratification convention, they hit Virginia. And Virginia's like, nah, son, nah, son, nah, son. And it was Patrick Henry and George Mason.
Right.
And they were angry, 8 ways to Sunday, angry at James Madison for putting control of the militia in the Constitution under the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that because, despite the narratives that we have, the militias were not reliable when it came to dealing with a professional army, this foreign invasion. When it came to the British, sometimes they show up.
Sometimes they don't. Sometimes they don't. I'm sorry, I gotta go find my cows.
Right, you know, sometimes they fight. Sometimes they take off running. George was like, dang. What's a general to do? And then there was Shay's Rebellion, which happened in Massachusetts, where you had anger at the Massachusetts government for taxation policy. So the Shay's Rebellion, these farmers were attacking the Massachusetts government. Massachusetts government calls out the militia. The militia's like, nah, I don't think we're going to fight them. In fact, you had some members of the militia joining Shay's Rebellion. So Boston merchants had to hire a mercenary army to put down Shay's Rebellion. So the thinking of James Madison was that we need to get this thing organized, regulated to get them up to snuff, get them up to standards.
Right.
Patrick Henry and George Mason, who are large slave owners, looked at that and went, oh, no. You know, when you've got it under the federal government, that means that you've got Massachusetts and Pennsylvania weighing in on whether they're going to send the militia down when we have our slaves revolt. We will be left defenseless. We're not having that. We are not having that. And so they were threatening to scuttle the Constitution. But what the agreement was that there would be a Bill of Rights put in the Constitution. These amendments
right.
that would curtail the power of the federal government. And so when you think about it, you think about freedom of speech, the right not to be illegally searched and seized, the right to a speedy, fair trial, the right not to have cruel and unusual punishment, the right to a well-regulated militia for the security of a free state. That thing is an outlier. It is the same kind of outlier that the three-fifths clause is in the Constitution. It is the bribe to the South to not scuttle the United States of America. It is the bribe to say, hey, we got this. You got this. You want your slavery? You got it. We're cool with that. The United States of America is too important as an entity to have it disrupted on the shoals of slavery. So the extortion, they extorted the Second Amendment because the militia, what the militia could really do, so they couldn't fight off a professional army.
Right.
You couldn't count on them in terms of these kinds of uprisings of whites against the white government. But you could count on that militia to put down a slave revolt.
Interesting.
So the curtailing of Black folks' humanity, the curtailing of Black folks' rights is embedded in that Second Amendment.
Around that discussion, what was the consideration for these individuals in the first instance? So was the matter of the South looking at chattel property and how they protect that property against a Northern aggression, under certain circumstances. But ultimately that's what happened, right?
So the South looked at it as that you couldn't trust the North to protect slavery because you already had several of these states who had put in these sunset clauses because we had slavery in all 13
colonies.
That's
right.
Yeah. But several of these states had put in sunset clauses on slavery. And this is what was creating the consternation in Virginia. And remember, Virginia was a big, powerful state at that time. Just, it was one of the big dogs. And so when Virginia is barking loud and hard, no, and threatening to have a new constitutional convention unless they got the protections that they needed. Madison is in that Virginia ratification convention. Madison is going, look, you already got the three-fifths clause. Look, you already got the 20 extra years of the Atlantic slave trade. You've already got the fugitive slave clause. Slavery is protected in the Constitution. And Patrick Henry was not enough. Not enough.
Interesting. It's a little bit of a sidebar, but I think it kind of goes to the core of what you're talking about in the second, about the connection between race and guns in this country. How did we get to the point that this became something that was so essential to the South, but not essential to the North? This sort of dividing line between free states and slave states, North and South. I get it, 1619, the whole process and how that sort of evolves. But when you get to the late 1700s, and the sort of formation of government and the founding of this republic, is it because slavery had become such an economic engine for the South, to the point that the humanity of the individuals didn't matter anymore? Or I'm just, so people can kind of understand how something so horrid was able to really not just stain, but indelibly stain the United States.
And so you had this fusion of tapping into religion to justify the unjustifiable, to make slavery appear to be God ordained, because these were heathens, because these were savages, because of the curse of Ham, that this is their place, this is their natural status. Once you have it God ordained, and then you have the economics rolling out of this, by the time we got to the Civil War, slavery accounted for about 80% of the nation's GNP. I mean, it was just a massive economic engine. And for the North also gained lots of resources off of slavery, from the banking that the slavery required.
Yeah, okay.
To the shipping that slavery required. The North also got a lot of resources off of this. But part of what happened, and this is the piece that I wrote in The Guardian about the danger of white supremacy, is not just its existence, but that it is never held accountable for the damage that it does to American society, to American democracy. And white supremacy cannot be sated. You can't appease it. It always wants more. And this is what was happening with the South. So the South gets this fugitive slave clause, the Atlantic slave trade, the three-fifths clause, and the Second Amendment. And they're like, cool. So as you expand North, as you expand West, we want slavery to expand West. And the North is like,
no, that's not happening.
And you get this where, you know, Joanne Freeman has this wonderful book, Field of Blood, where she talks about the ways that Southern congressmen would physically beat on Northern congressmen and Northern senators over the issues of slavery to stop slavery from even being discussed in Congress. When we get to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, Slave Act, the North was like, okay, we're done. We are done appeasing you. We are finished appeasing you. There's not enough appeasement that will satisfy you. You want it all.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes the kind of break that we see where the North was like, okay.
That eventually led to the Civil War.
Yes, yes.
So you note in the second measures to expand and curtail gun ownership aimed disproportionately at the African-American population. The right to bear arms has been consistently used as a weapon to keep African-Americans powerless, revealing that armed or unarmed Blackness, it would seem, is the threat that must be neutralized and punished. Is that still the order of the day in your view?
Yes, yes. I mean, it is, think about how many times, you have heard about somebody Black being gunned down who was unarmed.
Mm-hmm.
But the word is, we feared. He was a threat. He was dangerous. So I think about, for instance, Jonathan Farrell, who was a Black man in North Carolina who got into a car accident. He got out of his car. He knocked on the door. A woman was afraid. You know, she sees a Black guy there, so she calls the cops. When the cops show up, he thinks, oh, great, the cops are here to help me because I've been in an accident. As he's walking towards them, they start shooting. And the language is, we were afraid. Think about Tamir Rice, who is the 12-year-old boy in Cleveland who was playing alone. And Ohio is an open carry state, playing alone in a park with a toy gun. And granted, the orange tip wasn't on this toy gun that said, hey, I'm a toy. Mm-hmm. But Ohio is an open carry state. And it says, the law says, as long as you're not pointing the gun at anybody, as long as you're not threatening anybody, you can open carry. So he's in a park by himself playing. The cops roll up, and within 2 seconds, they shoot him. And they say, we were afraid. He was a threat. He was dangerous. Now, juxtapose that to Kyle Rittenhouse.
See, now you're about to make me mad. Okay, go ahead. I'm listening.
So I'm listening. You get this 17-year-old white guy who comes in to cross the state lines and has an illegally obtained AR-15. He walks by the cops and the cops welcome him. Welcome him. Hey, we're so glad you guys are here. It's hot out here. You want some water? Rittenhouse then goes and he guns down 3 people, killing 2 of them. He walks back towards the cops with his hands up. The cops go right by him. They don't see threat. They don't see danger. They don't see fear. And instead, what we get is this rallying around Kyle Rittenhouse as this well-regulated militia.
See. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've left me a little bit speechless on that one, because it just wells up an enormous amount of anger for me when I look at and listen to that narrative, because you and I know damn well that if Kyle Rittenhouse were any young black man in America, walking down the middle of the street with an AR-15, that brother wouldn't get to take a second step.
Okay.
And we're not just saying that, folks. Y'all know it to be true. Carol's already given us 3 examples. You know, Tamir Rice playing by himself, right? Nobody around. He's in a park by himself with a toy gun. Well, who was the young kid who was in the Walmart?
John Crawford.
Who
was 23, and in a Walmart that sells guns.
Right.
In an open carry state.
Right.
And carrying a BB gun.
Right.
And he is gunned down by the cops because they thought they were in an active shooter situation.
Right. And here you are in the midst of rioting. The police are scouring around on high alert. And this young white boy walking down the street, having just shot 3 people, killing 2 of them. Yeah. And they just like, everything okay? You doing well? Hey, can you want some water? You need a ride home? They took him back home.
Oh, right? I mean, this is.
Oh my God.
Okay. So this is why I'm like, it's not about the guns. It's about the anti-blackness. It's the anti-blackness that were in the initial slave codes that said black people cannot have arms because they are a threat to the white community. It is the same thing that leads to the Second Amendment, where George Mason is talking about, if we don't have the militia, we will be left defenseless. And then I think about how Lauren Boebert talks about how if we don't have our guns, we will be left defenseless against the gangbangers, the thugs, and the drug dealers.
And they are, in fact, the biggest threat to America.
Ooh.
It's not Tamir Rice. It's Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yes. Yes.
So let's connect some final dots here.
Yes.
How do we? So I'm at the end of the day, and I say this, my oldest son and I get into really deep, heated arguments about stuff. And I always say to him, I appreciate the anger, but what's your solution? Mm-hmm. So starting with white rage. Mm-hmm. How do we begin to piece together a solution to that unspoken truth of this nation.
And thank you for that. Because I firmly, firmly believe that the vast majority of folks don't know how we got here and they want to know. And so the way that we begin to break the power of white rage is through engagement and education, by laying the facts out there. We've got that hardcore rump of folks who live in an alternative fact world,
right?
Who live in a fact-free world. There's nothing you can do with them. But the vast majority of Americans want to know. And so it is through these kinds of podcasts, it's through the writings, it's through the speeches, it's through the engagement on social media about mm-hmm. how we got here. This is how we begin to change. That's how you begin to break the power of white rage. When you begin to hold the elected officials accountable for enacting white rage policies, where they see that there is no gold in them there hills,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
this is how we begin mm-hmm. to make a difference.
How do we begin to turn that corner and put in place the right solutions when it comes to our voting rights and responsibilities, dealing with, as you walk us through in the book, One Person, No Vote, with voter suppression and those elements of suppression, which at the end are all meant to undermine the true essence of this democracy.
And so I started writing that book for two reasons. One, when I was out giving talks on white rage, and I have a chapter in there, how to unelect a Black president.
Right.
And I've got a piece in there about voter suppression, those voter ID laws. And inevitably I would get a question. Well, I don't understand. Why is voter ID so bad? And I thought, whoa, there has been a really good job in selling this thing, mm-hmm. in cloaking what it is really designed to do. It was that, as well as after the 2016 election, pundits were going, well, you know, Black folks just didn't show up because, you know, they couldn't stand Hillary because, you know, Black folks hate Hillary. They right. just couldn't stand right. Hillary, so they just didn't show up.
Right.
And I went, you know, this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. Maybe that might have something to do with the 7% drop in Black voter turnout, duh. And so I went through to systematically show how voter suppression works, to look behind the curtain of the Wizard of Oz, to mm-hmm. see the little man pulling the levers. Because once we understand how those levers are pulled, why those levers are pulled, then we're having a very different kind of conversation. So you have grassroots organizations that are doing enormous, important work in getting folks registered to vote,
mm-hmm.
in getting folks the IDs that they need to be able to vote, in challenging these laws that are about how do we keep Black folk and Brown folk and Native American folk, young folk from voting. Poor folk from voting. How do we do that? And so it is, again, by laying it out there, what really is this thing? What really is poll closures?
What
really is voter roll purges? Because you're like, well, you don't want dead people on the rolls. Yes, of course you don't want dead people on the rolls. But where they're knocking off the most folks are the folks who haven't voted regularly. And those are overwhelmingly.
I can tell you for a fact that the whole dead voter premise for purging voter rolls is a smokescreen for what's really beneath there. That then gives them access to going in and purging out voters who oftentimes are still legitimately registered.
Yes. Yes.
Because they haven't voted in one or two cycles. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. You don't vote anymore. You stopped voting. So we just, it is very much the case, folks. I can tell you firsthand that's how that plays out oftentimes. Right.
And so it is by revealing how the trick is done that it begins to open folks' eyes to what the lies of massive rampant voter fraud and election integrity have really done to American democracy. And this is why I really believe why we had folks standing in line to vote, why we had folks who were just chomping at the bit to get to absentee ballots to be able to vote.
Right.
And so it is staying on that. It is staying on making it really clear what these new wave of laws, what they're really designed to do under the guise of election integrity. They are about no integrity. Mm-hmm. And to make it clear why that is.
How then to wrap it all together, probably one of the more difficult and gnarly issues is the Second Amendment. We see how people react when you just, you know, mention, oh, they're coming for my guns. I mean, you know, dude, no one's coming for your guns. But how do we begin to better understand and deal with the realities and the truth around race and guns in this country? And how that probably, at least in my view, presents an even greater challenge. But there is this mindset now, and it goes back to what we were talking about, white supremacy, how that narrative is spoon-fed. And so connect the dots, folks. White supremacy through voting, through guns.
Boom.
And at the intersection of all of that, Black folks.
Okay. So think about, you know, Reuters just did an analysis or published the calls to the threats to election members, you know, election board members, election officials. And in there, you keep seeing, you know, we're going to handle this via our Second Amendment. And mm-hmm. So looking at who voted, we're going to deal with this via guns. That's the connection. It is about how do we ensure that Black folks don't have a say in this society? How do we erase the role of Black people in this society? One of the things that I talked about in White Rage was that what Trump wanted to create was a neo-apartheid society where you had a vast rightless labor pool composed Black folk and brown folk, just vast and rightless, creating enormous resources that would then go up. And the con man sold it that whites would get those resources. But mm-hmm. It wasn't about whites getting those resources. It was about a small strata of whites getting those resources. Mm-hmm. That's what he wanted to create. And so Make America Great Again was how do we create this society where Black folks labor, brown folks labor, and they don't have any rights? How do we do that? And so this is what this push that we're dealing with right now, where you see these school boards being taken over, you see these pieces of legislation saying you cannot teach about slavery. You cannot teach that there were oppressors. You cannot teach about right. these things. If we're not teaching these things, we are not teaching American history.
It's a new form of burning books.
Yes.
And we don't even get you the book to read in the first place. So you can't burn it. And what you don't have access to it.
Right. And what makes this so pernicious is that the thing about America is that it is an aspirational society. We hold these truths to be self-evident. And the narrative, the story of this nation is how folks have pounded on that to make that aspiration become real, to open up this society, to make it a full, vibrant, multiracial, multi-ethnic, multi-religious democracy. Lord, that's where your real swag comes from, right? And when we treat those aspirations as if as achievements, like we've already got there.
Right. Right.
And when we don't tell this real story about this quest to make America, America, then we lose big. We lose something so precious.
Y'all just been to class. I told you. I told you she was going to bring it. Professor Carol Anderson, she did it. And I am grateful. I am very grateful. I hope those who are listening to this take away some of the lines you need to draw to connect the dots for yourselves. And I talk about this all the time, and I was very happy to hear you emphasize it. Accountability. Why what we see happening now is allowed to happen is that we're not holding people accountable. We're just not. And it goes back to the question that I posed at the beginning around, you know, why don't we see the outrage? Why aren't people exercising the rights given to them under our Constitution to hold the government accountable? We are accepting of it. So do we really buy into this white nationalist mindset that feeds voter suppression and uses the threat of the Second Amendment against us as okay? And I really hope that folks listened closely. I would encourage you to go out and connect those dots. And one way to do that is to pick up a copy of White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide. Pick up a copy of One Person, No Vote, How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And pick up a copy of the latest effort by Dr. Anderson, the second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America, to begin to connect those dots and to help you not only inform yourselves, but inform your neighbors. And because y'all have that family member, you sit there at the dinner table and go, okay, you just need to shut the hell up right now. You don't know what you're talking about. You can help that brother by informing him with knowledge and information, but most especially holding him accountable. Holding each other accountable. Dr. Anderson, thank you so much for taking time to spend with us and to break in our new year. So grateful.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me, Michael. Thank you. This was wonderful.
Absolutely. Enjoyable for me. And I hope for a lot of our listeners. I want to thank you guys for checking us out, checking us in. Check out Dr. Anderson on Twitter at Prof. C. Anderson, that's P-R-O-F-C, as in Kaylee, Anderson. And check me out at Michael Steele on Twitter. And certainly do that download thing, because I love it when you do. It makes me feel all yummy inside when you download. It's just a good thing. And give us a 5-star rating. That's always helpful. Until next time, be safe, be well. Remember, Omicron is real. Woo. So get the vax, baby. Wear the mask, baby. We can do this. Come on. You know I've been saying it, so let's do it. Until next time, take care.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on chumbacasino.com. I looked over at the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's chumbacasino.com and live the Chumba life.
Sponsored by Chumba Casino. No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 21+. Terms and conditions apply.